Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Iran threatened the United States with harm and pain for bringing Tehran before the UN Security Council over its disputed nuclear program. These comments were part of a statement delivered at the meeting of the International Atomic Energy Agency, convened this week in Vienna to consider Iran's pledge to proceed with uranium enrichment. The statement followed comments by Vice President Dick Cheney in Washington yesterday. Cheney declared that the U.S. would impose meaningful consequences on Iran if it proceeds with its uranium enrichment activities. Negotiators from Iran, the U.S., Russia, France, England, and Germany have been meeting at the IAEA for the past 3 days, trying to resolve the international dispute. David Sanger is White House reporter for the New York Times. He joins us now from Washington. And David, now that the IAEA meeting is over with apparently no success, what happens next?
Well, it depends on how you define success here. I don't think that any of us expected that the IAEA would be taking any specific action beyond the fact that they had to get past this date so the referral could go to the Security Council. The absence of success was actually in the failure of all sides to come to any kind of an agreement between Iran and the Europeans and, by extension, the United States on something that could avert Security Council action.
And when is it expected to proceed, and is it expected just to proceed to the Security Council?
Well, it is expected to proceed there pretty fast, but the question is toward what end? And Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has already said that she is not seeking sanctions at this point. They'll probably settle for something that will seem pretty mild, which will be probably a statement from the President of the Security Council urging Iran to get back in compliance and so forth. And probably setting some kind of deadline, though there may be some opposition to that, maybe 30 days or thereabouts. So what this does is just it gets the process going and builds the pressure slowly.
Well, and you say statement as opposed to a resolution, a statement far less binding than a resolution. Is it thought that the Security Council wouldn't pass a resolution because some of the members, Russia and China, do have veto power and they're seen as more friendly to Iran?
That is certainly one concern, and there has been this continuing drama between Iran and Russia about whether or not the Iranians would take a Russian offer to produce most of their nuclear fuel in Russia. The Iranians, though, have insisted that they must be able to hold on to some what they call research-level enrichment capability in Iran, and that the United States says it cannot abide.
Yeah. What do you think of the statement that Iran made to the IAEA today? Actually, it read in more fully, the U.S. has the power to cause harm and pain, but the U.S. is also susceptible to harm and pain. So if that is the path that the U.S. wishes to choose, let the ball roll, which is probably, I think they mean let the games begin or something like that.
Yeah.
But what do you think they mean?
Well, one assumes, and it may be an incorrect assumption, that what they mean is that they can harm us in terms of sending oil prices up, which they could if they withheld production for some period of time. But their ability to do that is somewhat limited. They could do it for a while, but after a while, obviously, it would take a toll on their greatest source of revenue. The other possibility, of course, is that they could be in a position to cause us trouble in Iraq.
Well, and David, speaking of that, in the minute we have, we heard from a reporter last week who spent a lot of time speaking with neoconservatives in Washington. She said that quite a few of them said the plan is to go the same route in Iran as Iraq, namely go to the Security Council, secure a resolution that invokes Chapter 7 authorizing military force, then use it. Do you think that's a real possibility?
I think it's a much harder possibility to do now than it was before the war in Iraq. And I don't detect any particular desire on the part of the Bush administration to go that route, precisely for the reason we just discussed, that Iran has an ability to strike at our forces in Iraq in a way that did not exist when we were thinking about the initial stages of the Iraq war.
David Sanger, he covers the White House for the New York Times. He's speaking to us from his office in Washington, D.C. David, thanks as always.
Thank you.
did you know that Denmark is the world's largest exporter of sperm? That blonde, blue-eyed college co-eds in the U.S. can charge up to $50,000 for their eggs? Or that in the U.S., one out of every eight couples experiences infertility? Infertility is a painful prospect, of course, for hopeful parents. But Harvard Business School professor Deborah Spar also saw infertility as big business, $3 billion business in the U.S. alone. And she says, should we view it as more as a business with all of the oversight other businesses have? Her new book is called The Baby Business, How Money, Science, and Politics Drive the Commerce of Conception. And Professor Spar joins us in the studio with more. Welcome.
Thank you. My pleasure.
How big a business? Give us some stats.
Well, last year alone in the United States, over 40,000 children were born as a result of IVF.
In vitro fertilization.
In vitro fertilization, test tube babies.
And here's some of the costs that you detail in your book. People will spend $275 for a vial of sperm cells. Eggs go for $50,000 apiece?
That's at the upper end of the market, but yes.
Okay. To rent a womb, $20,000. To get a cycle of in vitro fertilization, what's the range there?
The average in the U.S. is $12,400. In states with insurance, it's less. In states without insurance, it can be a lot more. And that's just for one cycle.
Well, as you know, Deborah, people are going to be listening and saying, oh, that's such a cold way to look at such an intimate thing.
Yes, of course. I've been accused of being cold very often the last little while. But the argument that I'm making here is that we have to look at this market objectively because it's way too easy for people to get overly sentimental, overly emotional, and that's not the best way to make what turn out to be life and death decisions.
And turn out to be business decisions. You use the word market. It is a market.
It is a market. If you look at what's happening, there's a huge demand, there's a huge supply, and their price is bringing the two together. That's a market.
Yeah, and so that's the way you approach it, much in the way you approached in the past a book you wrote about the internet.
That's right. Oddly enough, I wrote this book because I saw what was happening in this market as being somewhat parallel to what we saw with the internet in the sense that there was a new technology, an exciting technology, created the ability for us to do things we'd never done before. And when that happens, a market gets created. And in the early days of the market, almost by definition, there are no rules.
And the internet being quite young, in vitro fertilization being only about 30 years old, it's completely or almost unregulated?
That's right. In the United States, in vitro fertilization and most aspects of the high-tech reproduction are entirely unregulated at a federal level and largely unregulated at the state level.
Many people either are or know a couple who is infertile and has tried to have in vitro fertilization. But some of the stories, some of the extremes that people will go to, you tell the stories in your book. We remember the British couple that traveled to the U.S. to try to conceive a baby with a genetic makeup that would help save their other child who was ill.
That's right. This is one of the farthest reaches of the market right now and one of the most interesting. There's a technology now called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. It's really a miracle technology in many respects where a couple go through IVF, and then right after the embryo is created, when it's at the eight-cell stage, doctors take a single cell from that embryo, they diagnose it, and they're able to tell whether there are any genetic malfunctions in the cell and therefore if there would be any genetic malfunctions in the baby-to-be. And so they're using that technique to screen for healthier embryos. What can also be done with this technology, though, is that when you have these horrible situations where a couple has a child who's dying of a particular genetic disease and needs a very specific kind of blood or bone marrow donor, that couple can go through IVF and they can select an embryo that will produce a child who will be both healthy and a perfect match to save the dying child.
There's no regulation around this.
In the United States, virtually none.
What do you think should happen?
Well, the last thing in the world I would want to do is to support some big brother agency to review people's reproductive choices. That's not what I'm talking about. What I think is that we have to bring this stuff out into the light of day. We have to acknowledge what's going on, and that's why I do use this rather cold-hearted language at times. And then as a society, we need to decide which of these technologies we're comfortable with, which we're not. And we need to think about things such as whether we're going to cover some of these treatments through medical insurance coverage. Mm.
And you don't come to any conclusions in your book, but you lay out exactly what is happening, the big business of infertility. Tell us some more of the stories, because part of what you say is that your point is to make people aware of what they're getting into. And I'm thinking of the 51-year-old professor
who was impregnated with eggs from two different donors. What happened?
Yes, this was a very interesting story. A woman, professional woman, who had already had children in a previous marriage, married later in life, wanted another set of children. And because her eggs were no longer viable, she got eggs donated from several different women, went through several rounds of IVF with these various eggs. And when nothing was working, sort of out of desperation, she said to the doctor, "Oh, just take whatever you have and implant it." And it turned out she got pregnant with twins, but each of the twins was from a different donor. And one of the donors had been Vietnamese. So she wound up with twins who were not biological siblings, or they were biological half-siblings, and one of them was half Vietnamese. In this case, I think the woman is absolutely delighted with her twins, but I think it just does help us think through the fact that we're doing things in a very different way than we used to.
No kidding.
And I mean, we need to understand what we're doing.
You paint a scenario right in the opening of the book of a playground of the future, kids during recess. They look just like kids hanging off of monkey bars and swinging on the swings. But you say, look closer. The two girls, twins actually, but of a sort, for one is Caucasian, the other half Vietnamese, much like the family you spoke of. The dangling boy has recently recovered from a life-threatening illness, saved by a bone marrow transplant from the brother conceived to match him. The children on the slide are from Russia, Guatemala, and Vietnam and bear no genetic relationship to the parents who watch them. If you look even deeper, you might glimpse the genetic triumphs that lurk beneath the surface, the cystic fibrosis that never was, the biological replica of a lost, beloved child. Now, you say these children are already among us. You don't mean the replica of the lost child.
That child, to the best of my knowledge, has not yet been born. What I do know is that there are parents out there who are trying to do that. And that, of course, is cloning. That's the one part where we do have regulation. So there is law in the United States that we can't allow parents to undergo reproductive cloning.
Mm-hmm. The major theme of your book, as we said, is that the fertility industry in the U.S. does operate virtually unregulated. How did that happen?
It happened for a series of complicated reasons. One of the major ones is that this country is so divided over the topic of abortion. And at some level, it's very, very hard to grapple technically with high-tech reproduction without grappling with abortion, because the basic raw material, the embryo, has to be defined at some level. And we don't want to touch that. No politician in this country wants to touch that right now. So they've steered away from legislation. The other reason is that if you think politically, there's really no constituency for what I'm describing. None of the doctors engaged in this practice want regulation, just like no one in the early stages of an industry generally wants regulation. The parents who have been successful in their quest really want to move on in most cases, and they don't want to go back and become politically involved in this. And many of the folks who are going through the process right now don't want to see themselves as engaged in a commercial transaction, even if that's really what they are.
Is that why so many people from around the world come to the U.S.?
Exactly. This has become the Wild West of fertility treatments.
Economist and Harvard Business School professor Deborah Spar, her new book is The Baby Business. It's about the fertility industry. And just ahead, some of the more controversial procedures that are available some places in the world. One involves an attempt to mix an older woman's eggs with material from a younger woman. And we're going to also look at a proposed Arizona law regarding the sale of eggs and sperm. That's all coming up. And don't forget, later in the program, Ice Cube on his new show, where white people become black and black people white. Much more coming up here and now. Harvard Business School professor Deborah Spar, her new book is The Baby Business, How Money, Science, and Politics Drive the Commerce of Conception. Now, Deborah believes the infertility market should be somewhat regulated, but that governments confuse different models. They either see it as a luxury, like buying jewelry with no need for regulation, or they use the cocaine model and, like drugs, ban it entirely. Then there's the kidney model, okay to donate but not sell. And finally, the fourth view, that the infertility industry is like hip replacement. In that model, there should be some subsidy mixed with private pay care. Deborah, the Arizona legislature just gave preliminary approval to a ban on the sale of eggs, but not a ban on the sale of sperm. Your thoughts on that?
This is one of the most fascinating pieces of this business. We have a complete split between how we treat sperm and how we treat eggs. And on the one hand, of course, that makes sense because it's much more difficult to donate an egg than donate a sperm.
Explain, because people might not know. I mean, it has to be extracted.
Right. When women donate eggs, they have to, first of all, undergo hormone treatments, which multiply the number of eggs that a woman will produce in any given month. And then these multiple eggs are extracted, usually through laparoscopic surgery at this point. So it's not a major operation, but it is an operation, whereas sperm donation, of course, is a relatively simple procedure. But even given the difference in medical risk and medical obligation, if you will, it's still odd to me that sperm is quite cheap to buy and eggs are extremely expensive, and more importantly, that there's such a variation in the egg prices. So sperm, with apologies to your male listeners, is pretty much one price fits all.
Yeah, about $250 a vial.
That's right. Whereas eggs vary anywhere from around $4,000, which is the going price at most fertility clinics, all the way up to $50,000 for elite eggs.
You talk about young college co-eds selling their eggs without their parents even knowing it.
Right. That goes on fairly commonly, although not in huge numbers. But there is a real market out there for what are called elite, or by some people, designer eggs. And they tend to come from, if you will, elite or designer women, and they fetch quite a high price. So on the one hand, one can be sort of aghast at that and say there's something distasteful about women selling bodily parts for such a high price. On the other hand, it's not quite fair to say that women can't sell their genetic material and men can.
And by the way, just to be clear, this sale is not regulated.
Thus far, it is not.
And there's an attempt, as we said, in Arizona to do just that. Why would they only ban the eggs and not the sperm?
Well, it's hard for me to defend that ideologically. I mean, one can argue that we need to have more protections for women because egg donation imposes some medical risks, and I would agree with that. But this particular piece of legislation, as I understand it, still allows for egg donation, which, of course, is medically every bit as risky as egg sale. So basically, they're saying you can give away your eggs for free, but you can't receive compensation, and that just doesn't seem fair.
Let's look globally just for a second. We said a lot of people were coming to the U.S. because it is, so, as you said, the Wild West of infertility. Why? How do other countries regulate reproduction?
Most of the other countries that have the same technological capacity that we do here have much greater regulatory frameworks. Many of them do ban the sale of genetic components. Many of them limit the number of embryos that can be implanted in a woman at a given time. Many of them put age limits on the use of fertility treatments. So in many cases, I think they're quite responsible regulations, but they do impose some constraints. And when folks in those countries face the constraints and have the financial resources, they often come to the United States in search of treatments that they can't get at home.
Well, and you tell of one story where it's the other way around. The American hairdresser who traveled to Beirut for a cytoplasmic transfer. What's that?
Yes, that is one of the very few procedures that has been banned in the United States. It involves mixing together the genetic components of two different women. So that, because it gets close to cloning, has been banned in the U.S. So there is this story of this woman who went to Beirut for what remains a pretty experimental treatment and didn't work in her case.
And how would that process work? How is that done?
The theory behind it is that as women get older, their eggs get older, and in particular, the substance that surrounds the nucleus of the egg, the cytoplasm or the mitochondria, gets older. And so what they do in this procedure is they take the egg from an older woman and they inject it with cytoplasm from a younger egg in the hopes of sort of
from
rejuvenating, revitalizing. Exactly.
From a
they
woman,
use
yep.
the cytoplasm of a younger woman. And it has worked in a couple of cases. The reason why it's raised some concern, I think understandably, is that it essentially allows for a child to be born with DNA from three people.
That's one technology. What are some of the others that, you know, are right on the doorstep?
I think the most interesting one, and the one that's most complicated to think through, is this pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. We have the technology already. We're using it to screen embryos for gross genetic misfunction. We're also using it increasingly to screen for gender, which is a little bit more problematic.
It's troubling for a lot of people because then, you know, the assumption is you could know the gender of your baby and perhaps decide not to have it.
Well, that's right. It's also being used commercially already. So for an additional $4,500, parents who are going through IVF can explicitly choose the sex of their child. And then if you take this one step further, once you can do the genetic analysis, you can pretty much select for a whole range of characteristics, height, hair color, eye color. And I think we want to think long and hard before we go too much further down the path of allowing parents to make these genetic selections.
Mm. Professor, what's the most surprising thing you learned from your research, the thing that took you back?
The thing that struck me most was that everyone I spoke to who went through this process, who wound up with a child at the end, whether that child was an accidental natural conception, an IVF conception, or an adopted child, was firmly convinced that this was the child they were meant to have. And I think everyone ultimately does see this in a spiritual, religious, magical way. And although this book is harsh and hard-headed, I come away with a real sense of optimism that people fall in love with their children regardless of how they get them.
Deborah Spar, professor of business administration at Harvard Business School. Her new book is called The Baby Business, How Money, Science, and Politics Drive the Commerce of Conception. Professor Spar, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And this look ahead tomorrow on Here and Now. If you're a Republican and you're thinking about running for the White House, chances are you're wooing the party faithful at an upcoming confab in Memphis. Also, the head of the National Guard talks about the challenges his troops are facing, fighting a war in Iraq and being ready for disaster here at home. That's all tomorrow. Stay with us. Much more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where
the 23-year-old Jewish man who was allegedly tortured to death by a multi-ethnic gang outside of Paris is speaking out now about his family's ordeal. The case has stunned France and sparked renewed concerns of anti-Semitism. Didier Halimi told the newspaper Le Monde that he was tormented by his son's kidnappers over 3 weeks. Through endless phone calls and emails, they demanded ransoms as high as $500,000. On the advice of police, he stopped answering his phone. Several days later, Halimi's son, Ilan, barely alive, was dumped in the woods, stabbed, burned by acid over most of his body. He died shortly after, and several days later, the father received his last phone call, warning, "You're next." Joining us on the line from Paris is Patrick Giraud, deputy editor of Le Monde. And Patrick, the interview you ran with Didier Halimi, the father, seemed to portray a man in a desperate situation.
During the time that the kidnapping took place and lasted, he got up to 40 phone calls a day from the kidnappers and the chief of the gang, whose name is Youssouf Fofana, French citizen of African descent, and was actually brought back from Ivory Coast last Sunday after having fled to this country in order to escape the French police. So Didier Halimi said that he was quite supportive of the way the police handled the case. The police has been criticized mainly by the young man's mother, who felt that they didn't act properly. But the father said that they did their best, and that even the decision they made at some point to stop any contact with the kidnappers in order to make them come out and say more, give more information that would help to locate them, that this decision was a wise decision, according to him.
Well, there has been criticism, not just from the mother of the murder victim, but of others, that, you know, this lasted for 3 weeks, and it was surprising to some that the police could not track down this Youssef Fofana, the alleged leader of the group that kidnapped the young man, because he was going to internet cafes, he was on a cell phone. They were quite close to him at different times.
Yet at some point they really reached the cyber cafe from where he sent an email. They got there 3 minutes after his departure. They were really unlucky. They even investigated the building where the young man was detained, and they passed by the place where he was.
Well, tell us more about Youssef Fofana and this gang, so-called barbarians, that he led. What do we know about this group?
These young people, male and female, have been living there. Part of them met when they were in high school. The youngest is 17 years old. The oldest, I think it's Fofana himself, must be 26 or 27. They are of various ethnicities. Some of them are of African descent. Others are of North African descent.
It said that a 17-year-old French-Iranian girl was used to lure Ilan Halimi into the hands of the gang.
Well, the modus operandi of this gang was to send young women in and try to lure men into affairs and meetings. And this was the case for Ilan Halimi, who was lured by, as you said, a 17-year-old girl. They did several attempts with various people. Obviously, their main purpose was money, and they identified people as being affluent, either by their occupation or by their ethnicity or their religion. These guys were prejudiced about the fact that Jewish people are supposed to be rich or to belong to a rich group.
In fact, Youssef Fofana, when he fled to the Ivory Coast, gave a very disturbing interview in which he smiled and seemed pretty much at ease, and he said that the gang did this, kidnapped and abducted Halimi, for the money because he was Jewish and he had the money, but it wasn't anti-Semitic.
Yes, this is a matter of semantics. The goal of this group was not to make any statement, any anti-Jewish statement. This was not their business, their purpose. But, of course, these people were prejudiced as they considered that any Jewish man or woman were rich just because they had a Jewish name.
In fact, there have been three more attacks of Jewish men over the past weekend outside of synagogues. And obviously real concern that this case is about anti-Semitism.
Yeah, but I think we have two different issues there. There is first the issue of anti-Semitism, which exists in France, and there is another issue, which is the level of violence in the same areas, which is not necessarily linked to racism, but has to do with the average level of violence.
Well, a commentator from your newspaper called the murder of Ilan Halimi a crime of the times, a form of magnifying glass on the real estate of our society. Was he speaking of what you seem to be speaking of, which is, you know, that this is more of a class issue and more of an issue of communities completely populated by poor, sometimes newly arrived immigrants?
Well, the community where this happened is not really a poor community. And by the way, you may have heard of the unrest in the suburbs in Paris, in France, mm-hmm. in November. This suburb was very quiet. Nothing happened there. It doesn't have necessarily a link with poverty. It has to do, of course, these people are not very affluent either, but they're not really poor. There was a comment which was made saying that the chief of the gang, Fofana, looked like some people we see in rap and this kind of culture. This is partly true. There is some culture of violence, of ethnic violence, hating the police, despising women, which is really part of the rap culture. And it's probably true to say that these people were who went to the high school but were not very highly educated were probably influenced by this kind of stereotype.
Patrick Giraud is deputy editor of the Paris Daily Le Monde. Patrick, thanks for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
And these news notes, two Birmingham, Alabama college students are under arrest for a string of arson cases that had baffled authorities in rural Alabama. The fires destroyed or damaged 9 church buildings in the last month. The two men in custody are students at Birmingham Southern College. Authorities say a third student is still at large. Investigators say the two will be charged with conspiracy and individual counts of arson. No motive for the attacks has been revealed. And this story about a drug we reported on yesterday, a promising drug for multiple sclerosis, should be returned to the market, according to advisors to the Food and Drug Administration. That statement came amid regulators' concern about the drug, Tysabri, and whether there's any way to minimize risk for a rare side effect. But the advisors were also debating some controls on who could use the drug, agreeing to a manufacturer proposal for a mandatory patient registry. They are scheduled to decide later today who would be allowed to enroll role in the registry and how tightly drug use would be limited. And still to come today, rapper and producer Ice Cube on his new reality television miniseries, Black, White, Families Switching Colors. You're listening to Here and Now. War Crimes Tribunal is in the news, not in Bosnia or The Hague, but in New Jersey, where a group of high school students in the town of Parsippany has put President Bush on trial for crimes against civilian populations and inhumane treatment of prisoners. Well, that classroom exercise has created an uproar. Tonight, local county officials say they'll vote to condemn it. Joining us on the line is Rob Jennings, reporter for the Daily Record in Parsippany. And Rob, how did this War Crimes Tribunal come about?
Well, it was a class project in an AP senior class, a government class. It has been in the works since January. It kicked off on February 27th, and it didn't draw notice for the first 3 days until we had gotten a copy of the lesson plan from a parent who was not in favor of it. At that point, a lot of the attention began to be focused on it.
And the teacher says that the administration signed off on it.
Yeah, the teacher and the principal as well said that this was approved in advance. The only modification that they made last Friday was to eliminate the verdict. There would be no verdict reached in the case.
We understand that, as you say, the trial took place last week after months of research and work towards it, but they weren't allowed to reach a verdict. Why not?
It appeared that the school was concerned that, you know, a verdict one way or the other could fuel ammunition to critics of the project. They wanted the class project to go forward, so basically the trial continued, but it was no longer really a trial, obviously, if you're not going to have a verdict.
Right. Well, the seven elected members of the Morris County Board of Freeholders, or sort of counselors, are all Republican, and they say that they're going to condemn the whole project tonight in a vote. Why? What is their complaint?
Well, they feel that since this has drawn national attention, they feel that it's putting Morris County and the region in a negative light. They say they're offended by the trial and the project, and they want to make it clear from their point of view that it doesn't represent majority opinion in Morris County.
And well, further, we read that some of them have said that at a time of war, it's actually, you know, a threat to security.
That was one of the comments that was made, but I think that the general sense was more that they disagreed with this project, and they wanted to make it clear that this class project was not speaking for them or for Morris County.
Well, and you've written that community leaders such as the mayor of Parsippany, a Democrat, the town council vice president, who is a Republican and an Air Force reservist, object to those objections. Why? What do they say?
Well, in the case of the mayor, he has criticized the class project as inappropriate, but he's also said that he feels county officials are overstepping a bit and should be steering clear of the situation. The council's vice president, you know, while he is a Bush supporter and he has said that this would not necessarily be his kind of classroom exercise, he sees it as a free speech issue. He doesn't feel it's appropriate to condemn the teacher or the principal or anybody involved with it.
Mm. Well, Rob, I'm wondering, too, because it's a trial, and so that means that students are asked to both prosecute the president's war in Iraq but defend it as well. Has anyone spoken to the students about, you know, any of the things they used for the defense or the prosecution?
Well, one thing the school board's president said yesterday was he suggested that the freeholders, before voting on the condemnation today, that they hold off and perhaps attend the school board meeting on Thursday night, because at that meeting a couple of students are going to be explaining the project in full detail.
And what has the board said?
The freeholder board?
Yeah.
They have said at this point that they're moving forward with a vote tonight, that they feel they have sufficient information to reach a decision as to the appropriateness of the project.
It's interesting because who knows? I mean, if the defense attorneys in this mock trial were the better attorneys, their side might have won.
I think what one of the council members in Parsippany had said was that they were objecting to the format. The presumption was that the president was an indictable war criminal, that you'd need to have that to even have the trial take place. And so I think they were objecting to the format, the mere idea of there being a trial, you know, separate from the innocent or guilty verdict.
Yeah. What are letter writers saying to you at the paper?
It's been a real range of opinion, mostly from outside of New Jersey. You have people who feel that the teacher is guilty of treason on one extreme, and on the other extreme you have people who feel the teacher is a free speech hero. It really runs the gamut.
Well, certainly, if nothing else, it's been an interesting class lesson for these students.
It touches on a lot of hot button issues. I mean, it really touches on, you know, everything from how schools are being run and the teaching and, you know, the war in Iraq. It really resonates with a lot of people.
Rob Jennings, a reporter with the Daily Record in Parsippany, New Jersey. Rob, thanks for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you, Robin.
And stay with us. Ice Cube's ahead here and now.
Black person.
No one knew that I was actually black when I had my white makeup on.
For 6 weeks, two families, my family and a black family, got together in a house in the valley in LA, and we decided to swap races.
That's the opening of Black White, a new reality miniseries beginning on the FX cable network tonight. It features Brian, Renee, and Nick Sparks, a black family, and the Wurgles, Bruno, Carmen, and Rose, who are white. For 6 weeks, through an incredible makeup process, the families switch colors. So the black father, disguised as white, says that for the first time in his life, a shoe salesman touches his foot instead of handing him shoes. The white daughter, in blackface, attends an angst-ridden black poetry class and sticks out like a sore thumb when she has no hardships to draw on. One of the executive producers of Black White is rapper Ice Cube, also star of Boys in the Hood and the Barbershop movies. And Ice Cube joins us now from Los Angeles. Cube, welcome.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm fine. Or should I call you Mr. Cube, as the New York Times has?
No, you can call me Cube.
Okay. Is this something you'd ever thought about? You know, like, I wonder what it would be like to be in a white person's skin, or I wonder if a white person could ever pull off being in my skin?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, you know, when you're younger and you realize that it's a difference, of course you always say, you know, it'd be easier, you know, if I was white. As you get older, you learn to love yourself and love what it is to be you and how difficult it is to be you, and that it's a blessing. But then you start to realize, could, you know, white guys my age go through the same thing that I was going through growing up day to day. You always wonder, could they go through that without, you know, going crazy?
Well, the characters in this, well, they're not characters, the real life people in the series get to find out. And I'm wondering, it seems as if they came to the role switch with expectations. Bruno, for instance, who's the white father again, he really seems to believe that the black experience is going to be being called the N-word. And he's waiting for that the entire time.
Yes.
Your thoughts on that?
You know, I'm a 36-year-old black dude, and you know, I can count on my hand how many times I've been called nigger from a white person with one hand. Mm. It's not that. It's the degrees of racism. It's the layers of racism.
That's what Brian and Renee, the black couple, try to tell Bruno. In fact, at one point, Brian, who is naturally black, and Bruno, who's made up to look black, go shopping together as black men. As they set out, they have very different expectations. Bruno speaks first.
I'm going to be polite and respectful, as I am to everybody, and I expect that they will be the same to me. I can't imagine somebody actually being rude to me or saying rude things. I don't anticipate that at all.
I hope you do get the experience of seeing that they're watching you a little bit different. You get a little slower service. They don't give a shit whether you buy this or that, or you do.
We're taught
looks
to look for them from a young age. We're taught to look for people treating you less of a man or less of a customer, less of a anything. You know, we're just kind of taught to look for that and to, you know, have enough armor so it doesn't, you know, crush you or hurt you to the point where, you know, you're paralyzed in those situations.
Okay, let me ask you this, though, because what happens in this scene is that, for instance, they're walking down the sidewalk and a family steps aside to let them pass. Bruno sees that as, you know, people just letting them aside. Brian says, see, they're afraid of us. They're moving over. A salesman comes up to Bruno in the store. Bruno says, see, I'm black, or in, you know, in blackface, and people are waiting on me, no problem. Brian says, no, they're checking you out to see if you're a shoplifter.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible, as you said, you're taught from a young age to look for those things, is it possible that Brian is, as Bruno said, so used to looking for those things that he's seeing them when it's not really there?
Well, the fact that it's such a cloud that hangs over us from day to day, it's like going out into the world without your umbrella. You need your umbrella because, Yeah, it might not rain on you right now, but it might rain on you 20 minutes from now, 30 minutes from now. It's that same kind of feeling. You know, racism is a dark cloud to us. You know, when I walk out the door, you know, if it's out there, it's going to find me.
Hmm.
Of course, in every instant, am I right? Maybe not. But, you know, I'd rather be wrong and kind of keep myself intact than to be right and kind of, you know, let somebody take advantage of me.
This is what Brian and Bruno really end up disagreeing about. Let's listen.
Right. You're sitting there and you want to sit on the little lily white pedestal and say, it's not happening in the world, and that's bull.
I hear you. No, I know it's out there, but I'm trying to enlighten you on the fact that you have to approach life in a certain way and not expect.
When I tell you about my life, you say it's a bad day when I tell you that someone doesn't acknowledge my existence, or if I speak, they don't speak. Everybody have a day on that particular day that nobody wants to speak, or I don't get good service, or it takes them too long to deal with me because I'm black. I've been black for damn 41 years almost. I know when I'm being bullshitted because I'm black, or when somebody having a bad day. And that's the thing that you won't grasp.
Some would say that if you just took the extremes, you know, and just really broad brushed it, the white family is presented as being sort of blundering and really not sort of getting it. The black family comes off as being maybe a little overly sensitive. I'm sort of, like, as I said, I'm broad brushing.
Mm-hmm.
Where were the sort of places in the middle? Can you think of some moments that jump out at you where something ran against type or that really surprised you?
I thought that Bruno gained an insight and a different respect for Brian and Renee when he heard them chastise their son for buying a $150 watch. I don't know if he was under the impression that, you know, we all, you know, grandmama, mama, everybody want the bling bling, but it don't go down like that, you know. To me, it kind of opened my eyes up to see that Bruno was really seeing that there was a difference.
Mm.
And by them going shopping, and Bruno maybe had the right attitude walking into the store, nothing overtly racist happened in there, you know. So these were moments where I saw that we were not only talking about differences, but we was kind of dismissing every stereotype that's out there about this race situation. Mm-hmm. You know, we was not just playing into, look at the difference, but look, here, there's no racism.
Mm-hmm.
Here, he went to the car dealer. If he didn't feel no racism, you know, I'm not going to say Bruno was just blind. He didn't feel it. Hey, it wasn't there.
It's not like everyone sings Kumbaya at the end. How would you characterize what happened?
I think there's a respect for each other. And this series is not, when it's all said and done, is not about the Sparks and the Wargles. You know, this series is about the people that watch. And for people to understand that racism has layers in everybody. And it's not just the extreme Klan guy or the guy in the leather jacket with the black fist. It's more of pulling back the layers within all of us and hopefully being able to see the world through the next man's eyes just a little.
Rapper and actor Ice Cube, he's co-executive producer of the new FX series about race called Black White. It premieres tonight. By the way, he also wrote and sings the show's theme song, Race Card. Cube, thanks so much for spending time with us.
All right, thank you.
But don't call me brother man, unless your ass got my money in your other hand. Pull that black man, that white man, but see a suit and tie, I still get your ass euthanized. Cause I never got my race card in the mail. Is that the reason why my life's still hard as hell? I've been to jail, just like Martha Stewart. And we both told the judge that we didn't do it. Did you get your race card? Hell no, I didn't get my race card. Race card, race card. Did you get your race card? Everybody, show me your race card.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Did you get your race card? Could anybody tell me what is a race card? Race card. Don't believe the hype. Everything in the world ain't black and white. Everybody ain't a stereotype. Just because I look wrong, I'm about to...
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories.